All your favorite CBC podcasts are now available on YouTube. The best in award-winning true crime investigations, hilarious comedies, vibrant pop culture conversations, and even more audio series are all available on CBC Podcast's YouTube channel. You'll also find exclusive video first episodes, YouTube shorts, and behind-the-scenes content from our hosts and producers that you can't find anywhere else. So if YouTube is your go-to source for podcasts, just search CBC Podcasts and hit subscribe, and you'll never miss the latest update.
This is a CBC podcast.
When you see groundbreakers in an industry, you often see them referred to as like the first something. Like Nicole Maines, for example, she played the first trans superhero on TV. She helped pass the first bathroom bill through the U.S. Supreme Court. And a first is inspiring, right? But like, what pressure comes with the first? How much does the celebration of a first stop a second or a third from coming out? So Nicole Maines is here to talk about that and all about her new role in the show Yellow Jackets. That's coming up. Plus, when you think about video game adaptations, there's like The Last of Us and Sonic the Hedgehog. You wouldn't think Tetris would make a good movie, but it's actually a story about international diplomacy, about the fall of communism. Noah Pink wrote the new Tetris movie, and he'll be here to tell you why Tetris is more interesting than you might think. I'm Tom Power. You are listening to Q. So back to what I was talking about, the pressures of being the first. Nicole Maines is from Portland, Maine. She was a plaintiff in the very first U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allowed transgender people to use the school bathroom that matched their gender identity, the correct bathroom. She was the first transgender superhero on TV in the show Supergirl. But yeah, when you're the first, who gives you advice if there was no one before you? How do you deal with the pressure that everyone's looking at you because you're the first? Today is International Transgender Day of Visibility, so we thought we'd catch up with Nicole Maines. She's also one of the stars of the new season of the show Yellow Jackets. It's a really great show about the high school girls' soccer team and their plane goes down, and there's like it's all about the impact of that. And speaking of pressure, Nicole has had to join the show after it already became a hit. So lots to talk about. Here's my conversation with Nicole Maines. It's very exciting that you're in the Yellow Jacket show. I mean, it's pretty exciting. I mean, like, it's pretty exciting to be part, to come in on a show that's already one of the biggest shows in the entire world.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. Very surreal. I find myself pinching myself regularly. It's actually become a problem with my primary care doctor.
Yeah, but, your dermatologist wrote me about it and told me to get you to talk to you.
Yeah,
about it,
So
many welts.
Exactly. Yeah.
Were you?
Actually a fake arm at this point.
Oh yeah, really? You just pinched it right off, hey?
Yeah, totally.
Oh, that's cool. I'm going to try that. Were you a fan of the show in the first season?
You know, I'd heard a lot about it, but I hadn't actually gotten around to watching it. And so I only actually started watching it after I got cast. I had like one day I was up in Vancouver before I needed to report to set, and I binged it all in one day. Not intending to, but I just watched the first episode and was like, oh my God, this is so awesome.
I'll never forget the day I heard their plane had gone missing. What do you think really happened out there?
All I know is that what happened was a tragedy.
Did it change the way you related to your coworkers? Because like the day before, you would have been like, oh, I don't know these people. I don't know these people from Adam.
Oh yeah, no, I was a lot more probably a much bigger nerd than I needed to be when I got there. So it actually probably would have behooved me to not watch the show.
What's the most unexpected thing about joining a show like Yellow Jackets in the second season?
I feel like this is kind of like a pageant answer, but everyone was so nice. Every time I walk onto a set, I keep expecting that I'm going to run into the nightmare Hollywood experience that I feel like we always hear about, of like, oh yeah, there was this total monster on set and, you know, just like threw things at, you know, ADs and everyone continues to be so amazing and so nice. And one of the greatest things was my very, very first day on set with Juliet. She found a moment to just kind of pull me aside and be like, hey, I know that this is probably really nerve-wracking, but you're here because you deserve to be here. You're here because they loved your audition and you are going to nail it. you were the person for this role and you deserve to be here. And of course, me being so constantly filled to the brim with imposter syndrome, and hearing that from Juliet, I was like, thank you. Oh, yeah. So that was really amazing.
Well, why are you filled to the brim with imposter syndrome?
I think I never studied acting really in school. I never properly was trained in any way. So, you know, especially going on to Supergirl, I remember meeting Melissa for the first time, having her just come off of Broadway doing Beautiful, and me having been like a college like art major dropout. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how I'm here. I feel like I've fooled somebody. I feel like I snuck in under the velvet rope and somehow crept my way backstage. And so that it was so bizarre. And then going on to Yellow Jackets, I'm like, how does this keep happening? How do I keep sneaking past people's security systems?
Yeah. It never really goes away. I hear. I watched this interview with Conan O'Brien the other day, and someone asked him, he said, you know, you talk about being sort of plagued with self-doubt, you know, in those mm-hmm. early days of Late Night, like when did that go away? And he was like, oh, it doesn't. You just kind of manage it a little bit, you know?
Yeah. That was something, Kyler had told me, my first season on Supergirl. I was like, yeah, I just feel like I don't know what I'm doing. I feel like I don't know why I'm here. I feel like everyone else is so spectacular and I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh yeah, that doesn't go away. She's like, oh yeah, that's forever.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, great. And I think I was kind of like, nah, I don't know. And now here I am years later. And I'm like, oh wow, she was right. That really doesn't go away.
But it's interesting to me, right? Because on Supergirl, your character was like not only, I mean, she's kind of a brilliant character, but also like a really notable character, especially on a day like today. I mean, when you were cast mm-hmm. as Dreamer in the show Supergirl, you were TV's first trans superhero. Talk to me a little bit about Dreamer for people who maybe aren't as familiar to the show. Like what drives Dreamer?
Dreamer is, first of all, a character that I'm so in love with. And I've taken her with me, and she is such a core part of who I am now. But I think first and foremost, her primary sort of character, like her primary directive is help others.
Yeah.
And she is a character who is so dedicated to helping other people and putting other people first, to the point where she will put herself in harm's way.
My first question, who are you?
I am Dreamer. My parents believed that humans and aliens could coexist, and I am living proof of that. But growing up wasn't easy. I am also a trans woman. I'm different, Ms. Danvers, but so is everybody.
And I don't know when that became such a bad thing. The greatest gift we can give each other is our authentic selves, and sharing that.
Sharing our truth is what will make us strong.
I'm Tom Power, you are listening to Q. Nicole Maines is my guest. She is an actor and advocate for trans rights and someone who has really blazed her own trail in the industry. She was the first trans superhero on TV in the show Supergirl. She's also currently writing a comic book all about her character from that show. But being the first anything comes with its own kind of pressure that Nicole has definitely felt at a few different points in her life. That's where our conversation picks up.
I never went to school to be a writer. I never went to school to be an actor. Here I am doing these things, and I'm bringing this character who's so monumental and means so much to so many people to the forefront of media. And sometimes I feel like I really shouldn't be the person to do it, but I'm doing it because I have a genuine love for this character, and I will always be her number one fan. And the pressure being, you know, I don't want her to go away ever. I don't want her to fade into the background. I want her to live up to the potential that she has. And it's just scary being the person who's kind of spearheading that, because I find myself like coming up with all the ideas and doing all these things. And I'm like, at any point, someone take the wheel from me. Like, yeah. I should not be the one doing this, but here I am.
But you've had that wheel in a really meaningful way for a really, really long time. I mean, like, if you look back to like your people who don't know you as well, I mean, like and I only talk about this as much as you want, but like you were, when you were 15 years old, is that what you were 15 mm-hmm. years old? You were the plaintiff in Doe versus Clenchy, the main Supreme Court case that set a precedent for allowing transgender folks to use the appropriate washroom, the washroom that matches their gender identity. And the ruling was a first in U.S. state history. I mean, you've been at the center mm-hmm. of stuff for a long time.
It's very surreal. It definitely adds an amount of pressure to everything, because the further I go, the more I feel the pressure to live up to perhaps a certain standard. Being a part of that court case was so monumental, and it was such a huge step forward. And nowadays, it's been very difficult feeling like we've taken so many enormous steps back, seeing so much of the same rhetoric that I grew up being bombarded with taking place in state houses across the country, and seeing bills being passed grounded in transphobia and bigotry and just hate. It's difficult now trying to do what I do and also keep my head up.
Yeah.
I found myself really struggling of late to keep my head above the water. And I try to, in doing what I do, you know, I think one of our greatest gifts as entertainers, as creative people, is to be able to give people something that makes them smile.
Yeah.
Which is one of the amazing things about Dreamer is, you know, as all of this shit is happening, you can see Dreamer and be like, okay, but we have a superhero who is fighting for us, who is one of us, who is showing people what it really means to be trans, and dismantling all of this nonsense that is flying around. But the pressure comes in where I feel like oftentimes I'm like, I need to be doing more. I'm not doing enough. We need to, you know, it feels like everything's slipping through our fingers. And I'm like, what else can I be doing? It's terrifying.
I think one of the things that you've talked about that really got through to me for whatever reason was, I read this quote with you where you said something like, yeah, sure, we've had trans representation in TV for a while, but it hasn't always been the right representation.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about what you meant by that.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, so there was a great documentary that came out recently. I guess not recently. It was 2020 it came out. It's called Disclosure on Netflix, and it shows really how we as a society and our culture has been crafted to view trans identities and gender nonconformance as something to either be afraid of via horror films, Silence of the Lambs, Psycho, Sleepaway Camp, or something to be disgusted by, you know, in Ace Ventura and Family Guy and, you know, all these, you know, things, even today in stand-up specials, you know, a lot of people taking, you know, low shots at trans folks.
Sexualized.
And it really sexualized too, as well. Yeah. And a lot of cop shows often being, you know, the sex worker or the victim.
Yeah.
In showing only that side of it. And so for the viewer to see all of that, who has never seen a trans, you know, they're living, you know, in middle America. They don't, to their knowledge, know a trans person. They don't know that much about it. They turn on the TV and their only interpretation of it is what they're viewing from their couch. They're seeing these villains or these things that we should be disgusted by or afraid of. And it's not showcasing any of our joy or any of our humanity or our reality. And so now we're in a great time when these characters are being presented as three-dimensional beings with multifaceted identities who, you know, have the capacity to make bad choices and make bad decisions, because we all do, we're all people, but they aren't defined by those. Now there's so many trans characters on TV, and now they're being played by trans people. You know, we are able to get up, share our own stories and say, this is who we are. This is how we present. This is how we exist, and share our humanity with people who otherwise wouldn't see it and wouldn't get to experience that.
Yeah, as you mentioned, every time it feels like there's a big leap forward happening, that you're quickly and sharply and violently often reminded of the steps back. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Let me close off like this. We're running this interview on International Transgender Day of Visibility. What do you think, if you were to look in the future, what do you think that day is going to look like for you?
I honestly think it's going to look like writing. it's going to look like I have a comic book with a deadline coming up. And representation doesn't write itself. But God, I wish it would, because I've been working on this comic book for 3 years and I'm sick of looking at it. I think it's going to look like just, trying to bring more, period. Trying to bring more, trying to, you know, this story that I'm writing has been such a passion project, and it delves into queer culture in a way that I think we haven't often gotten to do in comic books. I think it's getting to, you know, just show trans people as the main characters. It's a trans girl story written by a trans girl for trans girls. And so I'm really excited to bring that into the world. And I hope that everybody likes it as much as I do.
Well, you'll have to come back on when the comic comes out, will you?
I would love to.
We'd love to have you back on. Thanks for so much for coming on and talking to us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole Maines is one of the stars of the TV show Yellow Jackets. It's an excellent show. I also recommend checking out Supergirl, which I had never watched before I got ready for this interview. It's a pretty great show. You can catch Yellow Jackets every Sunday on Showtime and on Crave in Canada. 4 and 3 and 2 and 1, 1.
Hi, this is Abby Jacobson, and you're listening to Q with Tom Power.
Last week, I don't know if you heard it, I got to talk to the author Kim Twee. We were talking about her novel M, which is this beautiful novel. It's like partly about the devastation of the Vietnam War. It's also about like how love can sustain you through unimaginable things. So just the other day, we got some cool news. Kim Twee has made the shortlist for the Dublin Literary Prize, one of the richest literary prizes in the world. That means 70 books on the long list down to 6 on the short list. I'm trying not to do online betting for Lent, but I like those odds. So I thought in honor, we could listen to some of our interview. Kim lives and writes in Quebec now, but she fled Vietnam with her family shortly after the war as part of the so-called boat people. At the start of our conversation, Kim talked about this really famous photo taken in Saigon in 73 and how it inspired two of the characters in her book. Take a listen.
I saw it first, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, way before I thought I would become a writer or even to write the first line. And that picture stayed with me and haunted me for the longest time, because you would see like a very small child who seemed to be a little girl sleeping in a box, in a cardboard box. And then outside of the box, there was an older boy also sleeping. But, you know, they're all curled up like in the fetal position. And then at first, I just thought it was the saddest picture to see two children being basically abandoned or sleeping on a sidewalk. But then over time, you know, I kept going back to that picture. And then, yes, I did see the ball which they used probably to beg for money or for food, but also to see their hands. The hand of the little girl was on the side of the cardboard box, and the hand of the boy was touching on the side of the box. And I thought it was the purest form of love, you know, to see two very young children, one which is, you know, probably she was even a baby. I couldn't tell the age, but probably 1 year old or a little bit more, a little bit less. And the boy was probably, I don't know, 2, 3, 4. But they were so malnourished that it was impossible to tell, you know, their age. And I thought, even in the greatest misery, love could be so pure. And probably love can be only, you know, love can be pure only under these circumstances.
There is so much love, you know, you're right. I'm looking at it right now, and both hands are attached to the same side of the cardboard box as if they're holding hands while they're obviously in pain and obviously asleep. What did you learn about the real children in this photo?
I've learned later on that the little girl got adopted in the U.S. By an American family, and they even found the photographer, and so they met together, the little girl and who had grown up, of course, with the photographer. And that was the only story I could find about the little girl and the photographer, but I didn't find any stories about the boy. And I felt, I don't know, I felt attached to the boy, you know. I thought he was so old already, so wise already, for sleeping on the side of the box, taking care of this little girl. And I wonder if they got separated, were they brothers and sisters, or were they just two orphans who happened to be on the same sidewalk? You know, what happened to the boy? And the book at the beginning for me was to pay homage to this boy. And so I wanted to give him a life or to imagine a life for him.
A little bit of my conversation with the Quebecois author Kim Thuy. Her fourth novel, M, is one of the 6 books from around the world on the shortlist for this year's Dublin Literary Award, one of the richest literary prizes in the world, worth 100,000 euros. Coming up on the show, if you've ever spent any time playing Tetris, then I think you're really going to like the Tetris movie. It's not so much about like the playing of the game as it is about the international intrigue that surrounded its release. I didn't know anything about this, but that the game had to be smuggled, essentially, out of the Soviet Union. It's a really, really interesting story. Also, T. Thomason, who is from Halifax, Nova Scotia, will be here to tell you about the new meaning he found in the song Lovers in a Dangerous Time when he performed it at Halifax Pride. I'm Tom Power. Q is back after this.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science where ever you get your podcasts.
When it comes to true stories, like what I really like is telling a story about someone or something that you thought you knew, but you really knew nothing about.
Like if you think you know video games, you might want to think again. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You've probably seen a bunch of TV shows and movies based on video games. The Last of Us and Pokemon and Sonic the Hedgehog. You wouldn't necessarily think, though, there'd be a captivating story based on this game. Yeah, Tetris. How do you make a movie about Tetris? How do you make a movie about falling blocks, about a game you play on Game Boy for like 12 hours at a time? There's actually an unbelievable backstory behind Tetris. It's a story about the fall of communism, about like corrupt real-life business owners, about programmers learning how to trust one another. Noah Pink wrote the film. He's from Halifax, Nova Scotia. We started out by talking about his own experience of playing Tetris. His film Tetris is available to screen now through Apple TV+. Here's my conversation with Noah Pink. Congratulations on the film. Were you a Tetris person as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like most people of my generation, if you were lucky enough to get a Game Boy, it was basically what you did during car trips. And Tetris was definitely my game.
So let's set this up a little bit. At its core, the story is behind the video game Tetris is it's sort of about licensing rights, right? But it's also about the USSR during the Cold War. It's kind of a thriller. Talk to me a little bit, especially for people who don't know the backstory, about the backstory of Tetris and why it makes a good film.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, like you'd think on the surface, this is really a movie about contracts, which doesn't on the, you know, on the page sound very exciting. But when I started to research this movie, I was immediately taken by the story, not because of, you know, the boardroom dealings, but mostly because it's really at its heart about these two guys who ostensibly come from very different parts of the world and find this kinship over a shared love of gaming. And that was kind of what drew me to the story.
Let's talk more about that, because in addition to, like you said, a film being about sort of licensing rights, it's also, the film is set during the Cold War. Talk to me a little bit about that. Tell me why that moment in time matters, what you wanted to capture about that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting time in history. I mean, it's this movie takes place mostly in 88, 89, and the Soviet Union fell in 91. So we're talking about the final few years of the Soviet Union. So, you know, it's a country that was going through an identity crisis. And there were obviously many, many things going on. But one of those things going on was this debate over whether they should be exporting intellectual property or not. And it turns out that one of their hottest properties in 1989 was this small little video game created by a government employee.
It's unbelievable how addictive Tetris was, like right off the bat. When you were doing research for this film, and we're going to talk about the conversations you had in just a second. When you were doing this research for this film about sort of the relationship between the USSR and Tetris and, you know, American business people and Japanese business people trying to get the rights, what was the most surprising story you heard that maybe you weren't expecting?
I guess the most surprising thing was, one is, like, first of all, like the fact that there were very large companies all vying for this one game and just ended up in the Soviet Union fighting each other for this game. I mean, that's one thing. I mean, I think the other surprising thing was how high up in the ranks of the Soviet government this went, because one of the people going after this game was this guy named Robert Maxwell. I think his daughter, Ghislaine Maxwell, is a little more famous these days, but back in the 80s, he ran a billion-dollar empire, and he was setting out to publish the biography of Secretary General Gorbachev. And so they were pals.
We should give the Soviets some money.
They don't care about money, son. They care about loyalty. Premier Gorbachev is my friend. We're publishing his memoir, We're Loyal.
And so he really felt that he could just swoop right in and take the game because they were friends. But it turns out it got a little more complicated than that.
We had to rearrange the balance sheets for the year end. Small accounting quirk is all.
So I shan't worry?
No, you shan't. But Kevin, we need Tetris. Understood.
As you mentioned, these are people who existed in real life. Alexey Pajitnov, who created the game Tetris, and Hank Rogers, who the guy, the main character in your film, who traveled to the Soviet Union to get the rights to the game, they're still around. And you got the chance to sit down with both of them in real life and talk to them and have them weigh in on the script. Talk to me a little bit about that. What was that like?
It was honestly great. I mean, I wrote the first draft of this script on spec, which basically means I wrote it hoping that someone would want to read it. And so when I finally got it set up and had a chance to meet Hank and Alexei, it was kind of surreal because, you know, you spend, as a writer, you kind of spend months in your head imagining what these characters are like and trying to do the best you can. And when you meet them, it's always a little fun when they meet your expectations or supersede it. And in the case of Alexei, you know, he's such a gentle guy and so nice and so thoughtful and was really, you know, helpful and really wanted to, like, make sure that both I and the producers and the director really understood what it was like to be living in the Soviet Union at this time.
What did he tell you? What did he tell you about it?
A few things. One was just, he told me the story about his father, which we put in the movie. And his father was a professor. And in 1965, one of his colleagues published a book abroad, and that was illegal. And so his colleague was fired. And Alexei Pajitnov's father wrote a letter of protest, signed a letter of protest, sorry, tried to support the professor. Because he did that, he lost his job.
But the Soviet retribution was swift. He lost his professorship and was barred from holding a real job ever again. And it ruined him. And it ruined my family. And I promised myself that I would never put my kids through that kind of hell. But they are doing it again, Hank. And this time to me.
And it broke up Alexei's family. And, you know, was a really, you know, big trauma in Alexei's childhood. And Alexei kind of grew up from that moment on knowing the power and influence of the government. And so when Hank comes into his life, it's a little bit of a shock to him. But, you know, it's these two guys, you know, are so different, but they do find this kind of shared love. And it's and the story we tell is kind of how it happened, which is kind of crazy.
Did you get to play the original Tetris? Did you get to play like the version that he made in the kind of simple, basic terms on the computer?
I never did.
No.
I really wish I did. it was never offered to me. But we did, you know, it's funny because we did work with the Tetris company, so they had to deliver all of the different iterations. So it was really fun to go into the weeds on that.
It's funny to watch this film when I did, because for a couple of reasons. One is I'm in the middle of reading this kind of like gigantic book about the history of the Soviet Union right now, this book called A People's Tragedy, right? So while I'm reading this book, I'm watching the news and I'm seeing the news around Putin and Ukraine. And I was thinking about you. I mean, you're filming this movie in 2021. In February 2022, Russia invades Ukraine. And after doing such a deep dive into the Cold War for this film, you know, you have this new tension between Russia and the West coming up. Like, while you were watching the news, while sort of getting ready for this film to come out, were you looking at the film differently? Were you looking at the news differently?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously, you know, watching with horror what was going on. But, you know, it's interesting. I also, you know, did a little bit of a deep dive into Soviet history, but more so like the history in the 90s, kind of after the fall. And one of the characters in this movie, he works for the Communist Party. He's the Minister of Foreign Trade. And, you know, he kind of represents this guy who, after the fall of the Soviet Union, probably, you know, went on and started gobbling up all of, you know, the property that he could. Mm. And when I look back at the movie, you know, it's these guys who saw the writing on the wall and were beginning to take whatever they could that has led to, you know, this oligarchic type state that Putin inherited and really shaped.
Yeah, I understand that now. I mean, when early on in the film, there is sort of a character who kind of knows that the writing is on the wall, that communism is on the way out in the Soviet Union, and that he's like, hey, I kind of want to make a couple of bucks here. And I see what you mean, that leads to the sort of power structures that are in Russia right now. And you studied history in school, is that right?
Yeah, mostly 20th century history. It's funny, you know, like when you're writing a movie about history, obviously you want to get the facts right, but you're also trying to tell an entertaining story. So you're working with another side of your brain.
but I can only imagine when you were studying, is that what your degree is in? Is your degree in history?
Yes, yeah.
And I could only imagine when you got that degree, there was no part of you that was like, oh, this is going to come in handy for screenwriting.
Yeah, absolutely not. It's so funny. Like I probably, when I first started making music videos, I was writing short films and I started dabbling into features, but the true story thing kind of came a little later.
I mean, what you said there is interesting, because you said earlier that when you were writing the Tetris script, you wrote it on spec, meaning that you wrote it, I mean, hoping that someone would make it, you know, hoping that maybe someday it will get made. And I mean, 2015, like where were you at that time in your career?
I was living in Toronto and making music videos and corporate videos to pay rent. And that's about it. I was about to go pitch on my TV series, which is called Genius. And so I was basically like a year before, you know, my writing career really began.
That Genius, I should say you did this series Genius about Albert Einstein. That was a bit of a break for you.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I remember I was sitting in my apartment in Toronto and I got a phone call asking if I'd like to Skype with Ron Howard. And I responded, "What city is he in? Because I will go meet him." and so I did.
Where was he? He
was in Los Angeles. Right. And so I flew out to LA and pitched him my vision for the show. And then 2 weeks later, got another phone call asking what I was up to that afternoon. And I was like, I mean, nothing. And so they're like, "Okay, great. Get on a plane. We're going to pitch the network tomorrow." And so it was this crazy, you know, Hollywood story where you fly out. I couldn't sleep the night before and got up the next day and pitched Nat Geo the series and got, you know, a 10 episode order in the room and was promptly told after that would never happen again. And you know what? They were right. But it was a great start.
I mean, talk to me about what you were saying there before, the idea that, you know, you have this history degree and there's a part of your brain that is in academia, you know, trying to get things as accurate as possible and kind of trying to find the beauty in that accuracy of stories we may have heard a million times. And then the other side of your brain, which is like, okay, I got to be able to tell an entertaining story here. Do you find something particularly fulfilling about telling stories with that tension, about telling stories around real people?
I mean, I do. I love, when it comes to true stories, like what I really like is telling a story about someone or something that you thought you knew, but you really knew nothing about. That was the case definitely for Einstein. I don't think anyone really knew his life story. And when it comes to, you know, Tetris, I mean, same thing. I mean, the moment I heard this story, you know, something my gut told me that, like, even though this is about, you know, contracts, this is really a great, thrilling story because it's not just about the game. It's about the fall of society and changing times. And that's hard about, like, you know, this really great friendship. And so, yeah, I mean, I feel like what true stories can do, I guess at their best, they teach us a little bit about ourselves.
Yeah. It is. It does make me think, like, these things that I've used a million times. It does make me think differently about this sort of the society that I've inherited here. We've all inherited here. You know, when you look back at how the Tetris project started, you know, you were writing this again, as I mentioned, on spec, just trying to hope someone saw it. And now big premiere at South by Southwest, and you know, your own career has taken off as well. I know you have like a million projects in the works. How does it feel to see how far this film's come since it sort of popped into your head 8 years ago?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, like, it's I guess it's, you know, you worked so hard at something and so many ups and downs over those 8 years that when it finally comes to be, a bit of you, you know, I feel like when you're a screenwriter and many, many things in the arts, like, I feel like you just have to kind of delude yourself into thinking that it's going to be successful and going to work out. And that's the only way you can keep getting up in the morning and trying. And so when it does work out, part of me is like, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. But the other part of me is like, wait a second, Noah, come on, man. Like, this is kind of cool. So I try to balance both of those.
I'm just reflecting on that story you told me about Ron Howard and having to, like, you were in Halifax at the time.
I was in Toronto.
Oh, okay. Because I was saying, if you were in Halifax, yeah, I would be so worried that the flights wouldn't get in or wouldn't get out. And you wouldn't be able to make it to LA to do that.
Those darn connections. Yeah.
but well, thanks a lot so much for coming. Are you really good at Tetris now for making this film?
I'm perfectly mediocre, Tom.
Are you better than when you started the film?
Yes, I can now make it past level 6, but I am by no means better than that.
Noah, congratulations on the film. Thanks for talking to us about it.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
After that interview, true story, I downloaded Tetris for like the iPhone and started playing it. It is hard and it exposes my inability to think ahead. Like, I just keep on focusing on the line that I'm dealing with. I should be planning ahead, but I'm not. My conversation with the Canadian screenwriter Noah Pink, his film Tetris is available to screen through Apple TV Plus. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. It's funny, you know, a song that you've heard a million times can just take on a different meaning one day. Like take this song. It's a big song, especially here in Canada. Right, Lovers in a Dangerous Time, Bruce Coburn. But T. Thomason, the songwriter from Halifax, when he recorded his cover of it, it meant one thing to him, and now, years later, it means something completely different. Today, on International Transgender Day of Visibility, T. Thomason will tell you what he means by that, and then you'll hear his version of the song. Here's our conversation. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
When we first started playing the song, we were overwhelmed by people who really loved it. So I want to talk a little bit about it. What inspired you to cover Lovers in a Dangerous Time in the first place?
Oh, thank you. I don't remember where it started, but I know that years ago I did a cover of it with my band live at Halifax Pride, and I just remembered the way that people reacted in the audience and seeing people have this moment of connecting with something that they were super familiar with, but experiencing it in a new context, and in a context that I think for a lot of people in the audience felt like it brought the song even closer to them, and it allowed them to take up space with the song that was different maybe than they'd ever experienced before. And so that always stuck in my mind. And then when the lockdowns were happening with COVID, I was just like, okay, I need a project. Like, let's just do this. It's always been on my mind. Let's just do it and see what happens.
Talk to me more about that context. Cause I know, so I've gotten to talk to Bruce Coburn about the song before. And he told me a story about, you know, writing it during the Cold War, sort of writing it during this time when it felt like nuclear annihilation could be possible at any moment. And you just said something like, it was interesting for people to hear it in another context when you played it at Halifax Pride. Talk to me about that first.
Yeah, I mean, I think like for queer people to hear that song and trans people to hear that song and anybody who's part of the queer community, I really think we're in a time right now that can feel more dangerous than ever, especially for someone my age. We've been really lucky, most people around my age, to kind of live in a time where it looked like things were improving. And now I feel like we're kind of seeing a bit of a backslide, which is really disturbing. And so I think when people are given a piece of art that reflects their experience, especially when it's an experience that has been kind of tabooed or, you know, shamed or pushed to the side, and they're given an opportunity to actually find joy and connection in that experience and see that there's other people going through the same or similar things, it just is very powerful. And I think especially when it's a song that probably a lot of people grew up with,
yeah,
and maybe they didn't necessarily see themselves in, and then they're given an opportunity to be like, oh, this is my song too.
Right. So if I understand you correctly, like when you performed that song first at Halifax Pride, people were able to see it in the context that you just mentioned. The song kind of comes out during the worst days of the pandemic, from what I remember too, right? And then of course, this interview is airing on International Transgender Day of Visibility. And so what you're saying is that as trans rights continue to be under attack, I would even say, and as you mentioned, trans rights continue to be under more attack perhaps than even maybe last year or 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Even since you recorded this song, you're hearing it in a little bit of a different context.
Yeah, I think the context is always shifting. I think it's unfortunately often a dangerous time for queer and trans people.
Yeah.
And that target just always moves. And so a song like this is just going to be powerful forever, I think, because there's always going to be danger and there's always going to be fear in the world. But there's also always going to be beauty and joy. And I think this song like captures those two extremes in a really beautiful way. I think Bruce did an amazing job.
Have you got a chance to talk to Bruce?
Not directly, no, but I would love to one of these days.
Have you heard, has he heard it? Has he heard the cover? Do you know?
Yeah, they have heard it. They gave us their blessing, which was really nice.
Oh, that's great to hear. Bruce, lovely fella.
I believe it.
Yeah, and the song, this cover got you signed to a record label. I heard that on the way in. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah, this song being played on cue, actually.
No way!
Yeah, yeah. Shauna, who's the head of Six Shooter Records, heard the song, sent me an email and said, I heard the song on cue. I looked up who it was by. Do you have a label? Are you interested in working with us? And that was like, I don't know, the summer it came out. And then this past summer, we signed it up. And yeah, so it's been a meaningful thing.
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that. You know, I've been a fan of yours for years and years now. So I'm so happy to hear that. We're going to play it right now, and we'll see. Maybe you'll get a publishing deal now too.
Put it out there, an agent or something.
Yeah. So yeah, agents and managers, listen to this.
Got a great manager, but
okay, yeah. Okay. Agents and billionaires who are with loose purse strings. Listen to this.
Exactly. Perfect.
Tell me, set it up for us. Say who you are and introduce the song.
Sure. My name is T. Thomason. This is my cover of Bruce Coburn's Lovers in a Dangerous Time. And I want to send it out to all the queer and trans folks listening to Q today and tell you how loved you are. I hope you really enjoy the song.
Don't the hours grow shorter as the days go by? We never get to stop and open our eyes. 1 minute you're waiting for the sky to fall. Next you're dazzled by the beauty of it all. Lovers in a dangerous time. Lovers in a dangerous time. These fragile
when you
That was T. Thomason's cover of Bruce Coburn's 1984 classic Lovers in a Dangerous Time. I have to say, I rarely get to feel this way. I feel pretty proud, pretty chuffed that someone heard that on our show and it helped T. Thomason out, because I've known T. Thomason for a long time. He's an incredible songwriter, and I'm so happy people are starting to catch on to that. That is it for the show this week, actually. The show was produced by Vanessa Greco, Sarah Melton, Vanessa Nigro, Gloria Omoteo. It's her last day on the show today. Gloria, we love you. Thanks so much for working on the show. Mitch Pollack and Jennifer Warren. Our digital team is Amelia Ekbal, Shuli Grossman-Gray, and Vivian Rashad. Our podcast producer is Caitlin Swan. Our director is Matthew Murphy. Our engineer is Sam Hashimi. Our senior producer is Lise Hossein. And McKeegan is the executive producer of Q. My name is Tom Power. I'm the host. See you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.